Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Coach Mueller, thanks for taking the time to join us on USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Keith.
Coach, before we get into some of your background, the part I want to focus on here is you've been at WashU, I believe, 14 years now. Is that correct?
Correct.
That is, in the coaching profession, you know, especially college ranks, you don't see that quite a bit. What is it about WashU that makes you want to stay there and has provided the longevity that you've had?
I think part of it is I'm originally from St. Louis, so there's a natural draw there with having family in town. But to take it the step further, there's a special culture here within the athletic department, certainly within the university. We're kind of a special place, and you have the opportunity to work with some great people and certainly get a chance to work with some great student athletes as well.
And I know before you came to WashU, you were a high school coach, an assistant football and assistant wrestling coach. In fact, Missouri Assistant Wrestling Coach of the Year in one of your years. So talk to us a little bit about your philosophy on the multi-sport athlete.
That's going back a little over a decade, but I know one of the things that was preached to me during my days in high school football as a player was having the opportunity to compete, not just spending time in the weight room or getting out to different combines and things like that, which were kind of popping up at the time, wasn't really the focus. Get out, compete, even if it's a sport that you don't necessarily like. It's not the top of your list, but if you know it's going to help prepare you for football season and you're having the opportunity to go against somebody else, that's something that was looked very strongly upon by our coaches in high school, and it's certainly something that I bought into and preached to my guys for the short amount of time that I coached high school football, but certainly carried that through helping out in the other sports. And it carries over, too. I think they released a statistic from the NFL draft from last week where over 80% of the players that were taken were multi-sport guys. So I think it helps with the overall athleticism with things that will convert over to the football field in the fall.
Coach, you mentioned that culture piece is something that really keeps you at WashU and something that starts in your athletic department and makes its way down. And as an assistant coach, I think you understand especially that you're in charge of a unit, you know, the offensive unit, that really the head coach can only do so much in driving culture. That really has to come from the assistants. So what is your role and what do you do in helping build that culture at WashU?
It starts on day one when we start recruiting guys, so they understand kind of the vision on what we want as a program, certainly what we want as far as setting the vision offensively and defensively for the type of player that we're looking for, the expectations kind of going forward, all the different demands that come academically at a school like WashU, but still having that drive to want to be the best at what they're doing out on the field. So I think our guys, that's part of the reason why they ultimately choose to buy in before they even step foot on campus as an actual student. They kind of know the expectations. And then from that point on, it's just kind of bringing them together so they can kind of take that next step forward. Because guys are going to develop at different rates, but at least they have a very sound understanding of kind of what we want out of them, and also that we're there to help support them for them to reach their goals.
Coach, the challenge you have at a WashU is that you can't just get any player that you want, that there's some extremely high academic standards, that you're also recruiting some of the best students in the country. We've seen a place like Stanford have success in building a culture where some of the best student athletes are able to excel both on and off the field. How are you able to do that at WashU?
I think part of the initial thing, unlike some of the other schools across the nation, we have an initial draw because of the academic background of the school. So we are going to attract the top students from across all 50 states. I think ultimately finding the guys that feel that this is the right fit for the balance of academics and athletics ultimately choose to come here. And a lot of them might have had the opportunity to play at much higher levels. Some of them might even have had the opportunity to play other positions. So it does take a little bit of understanding on the player side of things, but also some flexibility on the coaching side of things to say, we have We had a kid last year. He was our number two quarterback his sophomore, junior year. At one point in time, he was battling to be the starter. He was recruited by some FCS and even some FBS schools through his high school career. Didn't want him to sit his senior year, and he came to this school to become a business student. Great player, but wasn't going to beat out our other quarterback. We moved him to tight end, and he was a first-team All-American. So I think we do have to have a little bit of flexibility, so it's not like we're going to take one guy at every single position, one quarterback, one wide receiver, or two wide receivers, a tight end, five linemen, all across the board on both sides of the football. But we do a pretty nice job of making sure that it's at least the guys know the academic rigors. They want some of the things that come out of that, but they also still want to compete at a high level of football, and that's ultimately why they end up here.
Coach, that culture obviously for you has led to a very high performing offense. You guys have rewritten the record books at WashU. You're putting statistics up that put you in the top 25 in the country. I believe you're number 7 in passing this past year. Third downs, you guys are up there in the top 25. First of all, what's the philosophy of your offense that that you guys begin with?
Sure. There's some constraints. I don't necessarily call them constraints, but there's some pillars that are handed down from the head coach. So our head coach, Larry Kimbaum, these have not changed for as long as he's been here. He's close to being at WashU for 30 years. The first one being the Bear 60, as it's called. The number of runs and the number of completed passes throughout the course of a game has to be above 60. Is one of like the target pieces of that philosophy. The second piece of winning the turnover margin, of making sure that we're plus two coming out at the end of the ball game. So on our end, making sure we're not loose with the football or making poor decisions at the quarterback position. And then the last piece of explosive plays, more than our opponent. And we tab explosive plays of being runs of 10 yards or more and passes of 15 yards or more, which is different than some other places, but that's at least the framework that we have. So those are the initial things that are kind of handed to me, and our offense has morphed and changed almost on a yearly basis based on the personnel that we have. But to take it to kind of the direction that we've gone to, we are a tempo offense. That was one of the additional challenges that was thrown out a few years back that seems to be something that's spreading across the country, not just to kind of go through the motions, but become the fastest team in the country. So we're moving at a pretty fast pace. We have the ability to change formation and motion at the same time of while we're pushing that tempo with typically somewhere between 30 and 35 seconds left on the play clock. And we're going to take that piece of forcing the defenses to have to align to a lot of the different things that we're throwing at them with having our guys stretch the width of the field on every single play, stretching the depth of the field on every single play to basically make the defense cover every inch, defend every inch of the field, and then making sure our quarterbacks know that the right things to put us into or the right piece to execute in order to take advantage of that. And that's really, if you cut it all down, the philosophical pillars with the Bear 60, WTM, and explosive plays, that's kind of like the foundation piece. And then the other piece is with the tempo, being able to force that defense to cover every inch of the field on every play.
And those are two things I'd like to delve into a little bit more. Talk to me first about the Bear 60. It's actually, in all my studies, I haven't come across that statistic like that, but I'm sure there's some very good rationale behind why you want a total of 60 runs and or completed passes.
It was sometime back in the 90s, we actually did a study, and it was on all levels of football, NFL at the time, Division I, 1AA, Division II, Division III, and even NAIA, of looking at every single game and being able to count, just based off the stat sheets, the number of runs and the number of completed passes, the teams that executed that won like 88% of their games. And obviously there's other factors that tie in with it, but if there could be a goal to strive for offensively, if you could hit that mark, and if the indicator was going to be you have close to a 90% chance of winning the game, that was certainly something great to shoot for. We've looked at that again since the changing of some of the different rules that the NCAA has had with the play clock through the years, and when they're starting and stopping the game clock, with some of the different changes, stuff with tempo, with the number of plays that are being added to the game, and it's really kind of been unchanged. So it's still a focal point for what we do.
That's a very interesting statistic, and I think the correlation to winning is what grabs your attention right there. That 90% chance of winning, if you accomplish that goal, I think is something a lot of coaches should really look into. So thanks for sharing that. The second thing you mentioned was your tempo and how fast you go. So first of all, what's your method of communication from the sideline?
We actually went through all of our formations. It's actually something I would suggest to just about anybody that's calling an offense. You can look at some of the pro notebooks that have 5, 6, sometimes even 10 pages of alignments to put your guys in different positions. We basically sat down, cut everything down to size, and said, these guys are lining up in pretty much the exact same position 75-80% of the time. Why are we even calling that particular piece if we're only moving one or two guys around? So we'll call in or signal in. I guess you could call it a formation piece. It's really one guy moving around that gets us into some of the different alignments, as opposed to just being stuck in, I guess, 10 personnel with two wide receivers on each side, or occasionally three receivers on one side and one on the other. But it gives us a lot of flexibility for being able to switch up the formations. That's usually the first thing that's signaled in, and it's really simple for our alignments on where we want those guys to be. If we want that guy to line up on the hash, we signal in hash. He lines up on the hash. If we want him to line up as a tight end to the right, we signal right. Tight end to the left, same thing that way. And if we want him into the boundary as a receiver to kind of get into traditional 10 personnel, we'll signal bench, which is he lines up to the nearest bench, whether it's our home bench or the visitor's bench, whichever one's the shortest distance into the boundary. So as far as getting the alignments to be able to line up in a lot of different ways quickly, that was kind of one of our first pieces that we wanted to make sure was condensed down so we could move quicker and communicate faster. That's kind of our base package that I'll tell the kids on the sideline when we're in the huddle getting ready to go out with the personnel that's in there. We're going to be in our base package, and I'll make sure that one guy that's going to be moving around knows where he's going to be. That he's going to be our shifter, our H. That is. We have other packages that we'll get into with kind of nub sets with a tight end into the boundary that'll flip some guys around, but it's not really our base. It's just kind of change ups throughout the course of a game. But as far as the actual communication stuff, it really is directly to the queue. Who's talking to that one kid. Everybody else is getting lined up pretty quickly. For our base call, like if we had to hang our hat on one thing, I guess it would be our inside zone with some sort of quick to the field and some sort of quick game piece to the boundary. It could be one of a multitude of different options that end up getting called by the quarterback, and everything is in his hands. So we do look at like the depth, eyes, and leverage of the corners, both to the field and to the boundary. We look at the whole defender out to the field. Is he more of a pass defender on number two? Are his eyes more focused on the end man on the line of scrimmage into the backfield to the quarterback and tailback? And then we kind of go from there. So we'll do a decent amount of bubbles to the field. We'll do a decent amount of kind of the now or that quick screen out to the field. Hitches and fades into the boundary, again, kind of based on the depth, eyes, and leverage of that corner. Have ability for slants, bubble slants to the field. So there's a lot of flexibility with the quick game piece for the quarterback. And if those are taken away, I mean, we certainly have the ability to run the football. So for our base stuff, I'll signal in that small piece of the formation change up. If it's an inside zone or a counter outside, whatever happens to be as far as the run call, and then the quick pieces are tied in that the quarterback will call both out to the field and to the boundary.
Now, Coach, as you get into some situational football, and let's start with just short yardage or goal line, do you stay in that base? It seems like you're, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, you're in a base 11 personnel. Do you stay in that, or do you guys get into some other things?
We'll do both. We have the ability to switch the package and get an extra big guy in there if it happens to be a tight end, H-back type of guy. A lot of times we'll just stay in our base. I mean, with the piece that we're looking for all of our base stuff is that we're getting at least 4 yards per play at least a 60% consistency rate, where we're either getting 4 yards or more, or we're converting for a first down. So even if it's third and one, it's typically a time when some of the different defenses will try and heat things up or pinch their lines or play some line games, things like that, to try and eat up some of the gaps. We're still going to do our stuff. And if we have that quick out to the field or the hitch into the boundary, or if it happens to be the inside zone or counter, whatever run play it is that's been called, I'll leave it open for the quarterback to put us in the best situation, because he can see the field from that position a lot of times better than I can from the sideline or from with a coach up in the booth.
Now, if you do get into some of those bigger packages, adding a tight end into the game, how does that change your communication from the sideline as to where, you know, your player is adjusting, and what do you do with that other guy now?
So I kind of said, like, our base is typically with two receivers to the field, one to the boundary, with a guy kind of moving around that can line up as a tight end or line up as a wide receiver. That's what we typically call our flex package, with our Y flexed out. We do have what we call our field package, where our Y is a tight end. As far as a communication piece, that we still have an H that's in the huddle before we head out to the field on the sideline, and all the communication pieces are exactly the same. So if I want that guy to line up on the hash, he lines up on the hash. If I want him to line up into the boundary as a receiver with kind of twins to the boundary, tight end, flanker to the field, we have the ability to still move those around. If from a personnel standpoint, I can do that as well with two tight ends, and have that guy in a left set, which gets us into a doubles look, a true 12 look. So it gives us a lot of flexibility. But as far as all the alignments go and the piece that actually has to be communicated to our guys, it's consistent. It's the same thing all the way through. The other thing that we found has benefited us too is for the teams that try and spend a lot of time stealing signals and things like that, it's kind of hard when the same signal in one of our packages, like our flex package with a left call, is a tight end into the boundary with three receivers, kind of standard 11 look, and a left call out of our field package is doubles. So it does put some added pressures and takes away a lot of some of the different tendency things that teams try and pick up on.
Now, looking at this past season, Coach, you guys were number 7 in the nation in passing at over 350 yards per game, which obviously you're doing a great job passing the ball. What is your base pass concept?
As I mentioned, like, as far as our base call, like, I'll signal in whatever run it happens to be with the quick pieces tied to it.
Right.
It could be, I mean, we spend a decent amount of time with bubbles and quicks, whether it's two receivers out to the field, three receivers out to the field, then also taking the freebies where if a corner's going to play at 8-9 yards, some of the funky stems, or we know he's going to be bailing on the snap, why not take the free 6 yards every single time? So that's kind of a big chunk of some of the passing stuff. I mean, to get to 350 yards a game, you'd have to do that a lot. So we do a decent amount of five-step, some sprint-out stuff and play action as well. But I would say probably 65% of what we do offensively is framed in that initial base call sort of setup. We're probably somewhere around 25% five-step. So we do a decent amount of pushing the ball down the field as well.
How many concepts do you carry in your five-step package?
Our five-step stuff is chunked as well. So there's one of the issues. We had a coach that was in the area a few years ago that was a longtime coach for the St. Louis Rams, formerly St. Louis Rams, that spent about a week with us. And having the opportunity to pick his brain with all the different concepts that are available with the numbering system was outstanding. We were more of a full concept team before, where it was like our middle concept was a four-vert piece. Our cross concept was kind of the old NCAA concept with the high-low, with the high-low reads. But the thing that, and kind of getting an opportunity to sit with that coach with the numbering system was it gave you a lot more flexibility. You didn't have to tag a whole lot of things within the full concept framework. And it seemed like it had a lot of benefits, but one of the biggest drawbacks is you have to spend so much time with the quarterbacks. So we went to more of a chunk concept with pairing receivers together, where those kids have to memorize about 10 what we call patterns, where the inside guy knows he's running this route, the outside guy knows he's running this route. And we did that several years ago before we were a tempo, like a hurry-up team, just to make it a little bit faster for the communication pieces on what those guys were supposed to do, but still give us the flexibility of the numbering system. Not have to spend as much time with the quarterback in the meeting room. We have about 10 different variations of the patterns, and then it just comes down to how those things fit together. So we have the ability to do just about anything you could imagine that you've seen on a Saturday, a Friday, Saturday, or a Sunday in any game to get those guys to all the different segments of the field to exploit whatever the other team is kind of vacating. So there's not really one or two or three or four concepts that we're limited to. There are some go-tos, I guess you could say, that we run a decent amount of. But we do a lot of different things five-step wise. Just have to be able to hold up. And our offensive line coach has done a great job of kind of transitioning the last 5 or 6 years. And we've been one of the better teams in the nation as far as giving up sacks as well. But I think the most that we've done in any season in the last 4 or 5 years is maybe 12 on the year. So with that amount, the amount of passing that we do with that low of a sack number, certainly a credit to some of the stuff that the guys up front are doing as well. But we do a decent amount of stuff. There's not really one specific concept that we do.
And obviously, when you have that kind of flexibility, the responsibility of number one, making sure you're not carrying too heavy of a game plan, because it always comes down to practice and what you can do in practice. That's a big responsibility. And number two, the accountability of the coach to make sure that he has something that's teachable to the players is big, and I think you've answered that, and that you do some chunking. But let's look at that first piece though, the game planning. So with those, you know, that flexibility available, what's your approach as you break down film and being able to, I guess, really build on what you've done, build on that learning, yet provide something that's going to attack a defense the way you need to?
I think probably the easiest thing that everybody's probably familiar with, just starting with the four vert piece. Kind of how we teach it, all the different adjustments that we have to it, because that is something that we'll still run a pretty heavy amount of in every game that we're playing. Obviously, the benefits of it, if you're going to see any sort of odd coverage, you can attack the seams pretty well. One of the drawbacks to some of the four vert stuff in the past has been if you see a lot of even coverage, it's probably not your best call. For us, we kind of transition that as far as the pattern piece that I mentioned before. We have two kind of similar things. One's called a streak, as far as like landmarks and things like that. Our inside guy's aiming 20 yards deep, 2 yards outside the hash. Our outside guy is pushing to a spot about 20 yards deep, 2 yards from the sideline. If he's going to be even or leaving that corner by the time he gets to 14, just keep going. If the corner's going to be over the top, he snaps it off, runs his like fallout or his comeback. So we'll take that into a game. We'll probably run it somewhere between 5 and 10 times. We have variations of it as well, where it's a different pattern, but all the landmarks are, as far as destinations, are the same, but the breakpoints for that outside receiver are shorter. So it's a 6 yard hitch as opposed to a fallout route at 14. And if we're playing teams that we've played some pretty outstanding Division III competition the last couple of years. Like the corners at Whitewater were outstanding at jumping those breakpoints. They had studied our breakpoints and all the different stuff on film from the year before to be able to pump that corner and also be able to hold the safety while the receiver is doing a little stutter and go at the same time to go over the top. So that's one, I guess, small piece on how we look at how to pick on a particular individual while still being able to attack the different areas of the field based on some of the coverages we're going to anticipate seeing from just about every team we're going to play. That's probably the easiest way to kind of go through that one.
How much are you able to carry, you know, in terms of your offense? What's your sweet spot for this is the number of plays we're going to carry, especially in how it relates to practice reps?
The nice thing with all the stuff that we're doing from the standpoint of, like, the patterns, what routes the kids have to run, things along those lines, they're going to have numerous amounts of opportunities to go through that, even if they're, like, backside of a particular concept that we're running in practice. And we nitpick the guys that are away from the play as much as we do the guys that are to the play. I'll typically have, like, I have a script pulled up here from our last game of the year. I have the three different base packages, our flex, our field, and then we also have another one that's called flip. I'll have those three packages, kind of the top seven plays for each of those different packages that we have, some additional calls of maybe 10 different things plus some situational stuff, and that's really about it. At the most, it's probably, I'm trying to do the math here, I guess it's a little easier just to use the drop-down thing in Excel to count up what's what. There's maybe 25 plays per package, and a lot of those are just duplications of stuff. So I know we're hitting, like, our hit chart of certain calls enough. If you actually whittle it all down, it might be a grand total of 50 plays at the most. And some of the stuff we may not even get to throughout the course of a game.
Coach, as a play caller in the game, how are you able to keep your thought process moving as fast as you need to with at the same time being able to process maybe some of the things that your assistant coaches are giving you over the headphones?
The stuff is that we look at kind of going into the week, and I'll kind of take you from a Monday all the way through to Saturday. We look at the base alignments, the base coverages, base line movements, blitzes, all those different situational pieces with third down, first down in the red zone, pretty standard stuff for the majority of the programs out there. So we'll have our initial game plan based on all those different things. I'll have our coaches up in the booth typically for about the first three drives of the first half and the first three drives of the second half, just to kind of give me the initial pieces of the depth, eyes, and leverage of a handful of different defenders, more so than just, like, what was the coverage, what line game did they run. We can handle all those different pieces a lot faster on the sideline than we can with feedback from up top. And our coaches also know once a drive starts, unless there's some sort of issue with a guy having a equipment issue or there's a health factor involved, they don't talk to me. So once we start, we're going as fast as we possibly can. A lot of times I'm following pretty straight through with those first seven in each package. A lot of times it is formation related. We want to make sure they're lining up the way we thought they were going to line up. If there's particular issues with that whole defender, that Sam Studbacker to the field, where he's athletic enough where he can play the pass and the run, then we'll make small adjustments where we'll stretch that guy out a little further and force him to declare. So it's small little tweaks, and there's certain pieces that I kind of focus on from play to play after those seven to kind of know what to come back to and some of the other call options that we have to kind of sting the other side going down the field.
Coach, obviously you guys want to stay in that manageable situation. You know, 60% of the time your goal is 60% 4 yards or better. So you want to stay out of that third and long situation. It is one of the toughest situations, I think, in my opinion, offensive football, because your play script really gets dwindled down to a fixed set of things that you can do in that situation, and certainly plays into the defense's favor. But you guys did a great job in that as well this past year, number 19 in the country, and 47.8% of the time you were converting. When you face that third and long situation, what types of things do you like to do there?
The very first pieces that we look at are some of the different isolation passes that we use out of 3x1. They're somewhat universal against any covers that we're going to see. And take advantage of the ground we need to make up, whether it was due to a penalty or maybe we had an incompletion or we got stuffed on one of the earlier downs. So we basically will take a 3-by-1 concept with that boundary receiver, that isolated receiver, running that same comeback fade read that we do on our streak. And that's really easy for that kid to replicate and practice during the week with the technique of the route, being able to read it against a corner that's bailing over the top so he doesn't get beat deep, being able to convert it to a fade if he does end up getting some sort of press coverage, whether it's man or two-man, whatever it happens to be. Our quarterback knows that's kind of the primary piece that we're looking at, but we're not just going there no matter what. So we'll key a safety typically to that side, into the boundary. Our tight end or our number three receiver, if he's split out, runs what we call a pig, where it's a post or a dig. And if we have access to the post, we're taking it to the post. If we don't, then we're breaking it off underneath at about 12 yards. It's not a true dig. It's a little bit more rounded than that, but kind of finding the space in front of the safety. So it leaves our quarterback with options as far as being able to pick up that 12-yard kind of standard thing that's required in third and long situations. We'll bring a shallow crosser with number two from the field as an outlet in case we do have heavy heat where it's a 6 or 7-man pressure. A lot of times that guy can catch the ball, turn it upfield, and get more than what we need. Our guy that's wide to the field is a post, like a true post. He's so far away from the initial call, he's basically just helping hold some of those other defenders with our tailback flaring to the boundary as well to help at least force that Will's linebacker's eyes something else to open up the other stuff over the top. But that's kind of one of our standard isolation passes that's been great to us through the years on being able to either throw it to that outside guy, which a lot of times that isolated receiver is your best. We were lucky and fortunate this last year to have an All-American out there that had 100 catches for us. And it was kind of nice having that All-American tight end on the inside running that post-dig concept piece. So it was really difficult for the corner and safety into the boundary really to latch onto anything on a consistent basis.
I know before we started talking that you have the challenge of replacing one of your best that you've had at quarterback in a number of guys competing for the job. How do you keep that situation, I guess, a little bit more objective in making the decision rather going into subjective things and going on a feel? How does it become black and white for you and who's going to be the next guy?
Sure. And right now it's still unclear, and we won't be clear till now that we're done playing football in shorts in the spring. We won't be clear till we get the pads on in the fall. But the things that I talk to them, the quarterbacks, about every day is there are some obvious skills you have to be able to possess to play the position for us. But to take it a step forward so it's not just a gut feel and there is something tangible that the kids can kind of latch onto and focus on, is I do break down every clip that they have that they demonstrated through that we have on film with is he doing what he was expected to, kind of the alignment assignment, and he did what he was supposed to do correctly, that's expected of them. When they do something that's wrong, is it something that's a mental mistake or is it something that's a mechanical mistake? So if we're throwing bubbles and quicks into the turf or we're sailing a particular route high or low or something along the lines where I know where I'm supposed to go with the football, but I'm just not executing it correctly, that can give those guys specific things to work on. So if I know that one of our sophomore-to-be quarterbacks is having an issue with sailing the ball a little bit higher, I can look at his footwork through his drop. I can look at some of the things with his posture to make sure that if he is sailing, is he tightening his abs a little bit more to pull the ball down? So he has some specifics that he can actually practice on and work on to get better. The mental side of things, if I know that a kid is struggling with a particular read, that I make sure that I'm giving him the opportunities to get better with it. So just because he did it wrong, those guys need an opportunity. Even the guy, if the guy was coming back, that is our is graduating as our all-time leading passer. He needs those same opportunities to kind of work through some of the things. Sometimes it might be the first time he's really seen it against a different look. They need those opportunities to respond and kind of make the corrections going forward. So those are the things that they kind of get from me on a weekly basis. And we do that similarly at other positions as well, where we track every catch that a receiver makes through one-on-ones, seven-on-sevens, 11-on-11s. Is he having an issue with drops? What are the routes that he's having issues with those drops on? And make sure that when we do come back the next time, if it's one-on-ones and he has three drops on a dig, I may handcuff that particular receiver to say, when you have one-on-ones, I don't want you to run anything but digs, because we need to get better at that particular route. But getting back to the quarterback piece, that there is something tangible for him that they know exactly what they have to work on. And we kind of pull that piece out of, you're not competing against the other guys, you're competing against yourself. And these are the things you need to work on to get better. I mean, all those kids that first day in our quarterback room in the fall kind of hear the progression from me. My goal for every one of you is kind of a three-step process, and it's my job to help try and get you there. To number one, be able to manage the offense. Number two, to be able to lead the offense. And number three, eventually be able to lead the team. So it's not going to work for every single one of them when it's all said and done. But at least that's kind of the pathway that we work to, that we at least start with and work to on that first day at camp in the fall.
You mentioned a big intangible there, the leadership of the unit, the leadership of the team. How do you build that into your quarterbacks? What types of things do you work on there?
So there's certain things that I can talk to each one of those guys about, how they connect with the other guys on the team, obviously making sure that they tap their guys up when they make a play. And that's not just the skill guys, but if they happen to get great protection, or they see an outstanding block out of one of the linemen, I mean, those big guys need some loving too. But to make sure that when they do have the opportunity in their own way, because every one of those kids is different, that they try and find ways to connect with their teammates. It's not something that you can force. And there's some guys that might have outstanding arms and all the skill in the world, but no one's going to follow them. So that's something that's a piece there that I don't necessarily pick the quarterback. I know there's certain things that I want those guys to be able to do. It's my job to help kind of take them through the skill development piece. As far as fostering the leadership piece, you can kind of steer it to a degree with making sure that they're taking advantage of the opportunities to connect with their teammates. But when it's all said and done, their teammates are going to pick the quarterback anyhow. I mean, it's there's like an old cowboy saying, it's a lot easier to pull a chain than it is to push. It's not really something that you can force unless you really have to. And hopefully you have a guy that can connect with those other guys that they're going to follow.
Coach, you obviously are very attention to detail oriented, and I know that, you know, from having been around the campus and knowing Coach Kimbaum for a while now. But you can tell just from this conversation here. So how do you balance that attention to detail, all the work that you put into this? How do you balance that with, you know, you have a young family as well, and certainly you want to take care of those things. How do you find balance in your life?
I have an outstanding wife, number one, who's been with me. I'm one of the few guys out there that had the opportunity to marry his high school sweetheart. She is a teacher as well, so she's a former athlete as well, so she understands a lot of the demands of the sport from a time commitment standpoint, whether it's stuff during the season or stuff with recruiting or getting off campus and spending time in other cities. The other thing that kind of goes with that too is when you do have the opportunity to spend more time with your family, and now that we're wrapped up with spring ball and some of the other things that we had kind of going on with recruiting and junior visit dates and getting out to different places in the country, that we spend as much time with our families as we can. One of the pieces with that is that something that Coach Kimbaum is very vocal about, of making sure that we put in the quality work to get the results that we want. But that we're still taking advantage of the time that we have with our families when we have the opportunity. So the understanding piece is great. Without that, I know that there's probably some wives out there that wouldn't have the same sort of backing for the profession that I'm in, but I know that's a huge, huge piece in order to make this whole thing go.
Coach, I believe you have a young son, correct?
I have a 7-year-old and almost going on 2.
Almost going on 2. So you got one who's getting into that range now of being able to play, you know, organized sports. Obviously, I'm sure you'd want him to play football. As a college coach, what do you feel is the correct pathway now, knowing what we know as coaches and you know, all the things we get from our medical profession, et cetera, thinking about the pathway, is it starting in flag? How long does that go? You know, we're doing some things at USA Football with a modified game, smaller fields, et cetera. What do you feel is the proper path of development for a player today?
Well, at the age of like 5, 6, 7 years old, regardless of the organized activity that you can get kids involved with, it will pay great rewards down the road. I know that my oldest son, Corbin, I mean, he's done soccer, swimming, gymnastics. He's getting ready to get into wrestling and some of the other stuff, which are kind of foundational, developmental, just kind of standard motor skill stuff. With the thing with football, I mean, that's one of the things over the last however many years has kind of become a big black eye on the sport as far as concussion goes. I think if children are taught how to play the sport correctly, I mean, it's a fun sport. That's why I'm involved with the game in the first place. If they're taught the fundamentals correctly, they're athletic enough to control their own bodies, let them go out and have fun, so long as it's controlled within that piece of understanding kind of what it takes to play the actual game. I mean, I know that there's all kinds of advances with equipment and testing, and there's all kinds of research that's out there about different things, but it's the greatest sport on the planet, and there's so many other things that come out of it beyond just blocking or throwing or catching touchdown passes. So that would be my I don't know exactly all the different stuff that USA Football has at the youth level to that degree that they're changing their format with. But so long as the kids are being instructed the proper fundamentals on how to play the game, and they're out there enjoying all the different components that they're there, all the other benefits that they're going to receive are greatly going to outweigh some of the negatives that have been in the media and the press.
Well, and I think you hit on something that's important there. It really is dependent on that athlete. The athlete has to be the one doing it, wanting to do it, number one, having fun out there. And the coaching has to be good. You know, the fundamentals, like you mentioned, that, you know, this can't be a place or an outlet for, especially at the youth level. You know, I know as we grow through the profession and, you know, we get to the higher level, certainly it has its own personal satisfaction that we have in doing it. But the personal satisfaction for youth coaches, I believe, has to be in that you're fostering the love of the game, that, you know, yeah, you're not out there to be, you know, the next guru of offense, et cetera. So, you know, that's just something I feel is worth emphasizing right here. And it's some points I think that you bring up in discussing, hey, it's about the fundamentals and it's about making sure they're having fun.
Absolutely.
Coach, here's the final question I have for you. And you guys are having success, certainly, at WashU. What's the one thing you point to as giving your team the winning edge?
I think that probably the biggest thing that we've had that's kind of been in our favor as long as I've been here is consistency. Consistency in the type of student athlete that we have here. Consistency in the coaches that are here too. I mean, I'm the third of the four full timers that are here on staff. And I've been here for going on 15 years, and we have another coach that's been here close to 18, and our head coach has been here close to 30. So there's been consistency all the way through. There's no guesswork as far as trying to figure out someone's agenda or their intent or their expectations. You kind of know what's kind of laid out, and the kids feel that too. Obviously, we've had some changes with some of the part-time coaches and the other assistant coaches that kind of fill out the rest of the staff through the years. But the consistency piece, and then modifying the things that don't work. I mean, don't be afraid to change some of the stuff that you're doing to fit the guys that you have, and then find the best ways to go about making those changes. Look for the best ways to put your people in a position to be successful. And I think that's something that I know I've been a part of and has been strongly encouraged here of making sure that we're always kind of striving to find the not necessarily the faster, shinier thing that's out there, but finding the best ways to make it go. And that's something that's well received by just about every member of the organization.
Coach, how can our listeners connect with you?
You can connect directly via email, smuller, M-U-E-L-L-E-R, 22, at wustl.edu, or you can call me at the office at 314-935-4710.
Coach, it was great to catch up with you again. Great to talk ball with you here on the podcast. Best of luck to you and the WashU Bears as you get into the 2017 season.
All right, thanks a lot, Keith.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.